Do you own or rent your home? I'll bet you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico, our friends, make it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's all wrapped up in one. It's a good thing because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy, folks. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable Cars and Coffee, hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast, Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
This particular 917, as most people realize, is the car that belonged to Steve McQueen. It was the star of the movie Le Mans. It was purchased new from Porsche by Steve McQueen, Solar Productions, that was his company. After the movie, it was sold to a German racing team called Auto Usdal. They raced this car during the 71 season and a little bit during the 72 season. Then the car went through an interesting phase where it was sold to Richard Atwood, who won Le Mans in 1970 in the Salzburg car. In April of 2001, I talked Jerry into buying it, and he never regretted it. We've played with it at the racetrack a few times. Twice it's been to the Rennsport reunion, the first time in 04, the last time in 07. So it's been on the track, and I can tell you from personal experience that if you watch the movie, if you watch the opening scenes, when Steve is on Mulsanne, and you hear that roar that is right behind his head, it still does it. The adrenaline that this car causes will make you forget that it's really hot, that you're wearing a fire suit and a helmet and all the paraphernalia, because it shuts that switch off in your brain and all you pretend is you're Steve McQueen, and I was him yesterday. I can't think of anything that I would rather do in my life than driving this car.
That was Sam Cabiglio, Pebble Beach, 2009, talking about Jerry Seinfeld's 917, sitting with me.
Why
here in Malibu.
Why are you so loud? You're talking very loud.
It's Jerry Seinfeld, the ever-critical Jerry Seinfeld. Sam Cabiglio, his car.
Cabiglio.
Consigliere, and of course, the real Zuckerman. Hello, gentlemen. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. We have with us a very special guest today on Spike's Car Radio. From the elegant, transcendent, enchanting town of Lecce.
My mother.
That's where your mother is from. What town?
Lake Como.
Oh, you're from Lake Como. And you left at the age of six?
Five and a half.
I hate when people do that. That's a yes, just a yes. From the age of six, grew up in Italy, came to America. Had some awareness of cars in Italy.
Oh, total.
Yeah, Fiats and
Alfas.
Yeah.
Lunches.
And then came to America, and then soon after was drafted into the Army, went to Vietnam.
Right.
But you have car history before that, of course.
Oh, a ton of it.
Yeah. Well, let's start with...
Why don't you tell everybody your relationship?
My relationship with Sam is when we were doing the show in the 90s, I was starting to get interested in these old Porsches. I had excess funds, which I did not want, and to this day, do not want. If I have any money, I want to get rid of it. I don't like seeing it around. I don't like cash. I like cash flow.
Right.
And I started looking in Hemmings. That's what we did in those days. And started trying to decipher the 356 world, which to a beginner is very difficult, very complex. So many cars, so many years, so many models, so many specs, different engines, different coupes and cabs and speedsters and roadsters. And you get overwhelmed very quickly. And I couldn't make head or tail of it. But I quickly settled onto the Speedster. And I thought, well, here's a car that's really cool looking. I'm sure you can't drive it. I mean, it's 1993, for heaven's sake. You're not going to be able to drive a car from 58-93 in L.A. traffic. I'll get run over. I'll get, I won't be able to manage it. It's 60-horsepower car. And I found one in Wichita, Kansas. I guess I was just looking for a blue one. I flew to Wichita, Kansas. I met the guy. I bought the car and brought it back here and found, and this is really the beginning of my Porsche awakening. I got in this 1958 Speedster, didn't even run well, and pulled out onto Santa Monica Boulevard and found I was not only as fast as the traffic around me, but faster and having, of course, 10 times more fun. And the next thing I knew, I was driving the car every day. I was driving it to the airport to pick friends up and drop them off with luggage. And I was hooked. And then I came across another Speedster, and I had told Porsche that I was not comfortable with some of the salesmen at Beverly Hills Porsche. They were a little slick, a little cool, a little...
still exchange.
What's the word? Oily.
Greasy.
And all I had was an 88 911 Carrera at that time. And I said, I was talking to Bert Olander, who, Spike, you also know, was a great guy, ex-racer.
Yeah, he raced.
Great Porsche aficionado. I said, do you know anybody that could look at some of these old Porsches for me and tell me if they're in good shape or not? Somebody that does that. He says, you know, I do know a guy who would be very good at that. His name is Sam. And he made the introduction. And I believe you came to my office in Studio City when we were making the show. That's where we met.
I did. That was after I had gone to look at the car.
Oh, so you went and looked at the car.
Then you came.
It was a 58 Speedster. 84113 was the serial number, correct?
Very good. Yeah.
Thank you.
This
is one of the blue Speedsters. This is an Emery car.
Right.
Don Emery had done it?
Gary Emery.
Gary Emery.
Gary owned it. Don did a lot of the restoration on it.
Oh. And Sam came into my office, and he told me about the car, and he took all these pictures. In those days, in the old Sam days, he'd make a little loose-leaf binder for you with pictures, and he would write on a piece of paper and, you know, a three-hole punch paper. And he would hand you this book, and that's how you would get people interested in cars. Show them what you thought of it, and here's what it looks like. And, I mean, from there to today is 27 years.
Yeah, 26 or 7.
Are we saying 93 or 94?
I think it was 94.
94, yeah, that sounds right. So, basically, we're talking 25 years, and I've been very fortunate in the entertainment industry, and haven't gone badly. Let's put it that way.
You did okay.
I did okay. But the thing that really stabilized me, and this is now we're going to get into the philosophical world of the car hobby, is you must, with success and accomplishment, you must have madness in your life, of some kind. When one thing is out of balance, something else has to be out of balance. Mm-hmm. Any weightlifter can tell you that. You've got to have the same weight on either side of the barbell, right?
Yes.
So I found the car hobby stabilized me mentally, emotionally, intellectually.
It kept you out of the cesspit of Hollywood.
Yes, I wasn't inclined to anyway. I was never interested
That's
in
That's a shame.
I was a single guy, and I had associations of various kinds, of course. But the car hobby, I credit, and Sam, who, wherever I would go, whatever depth I wanted to go into the hobby, he was already there. He had already driven it, already seen it, already knew about it. And so I began to learn. So that is really the beginning of my story with Sam, which Sam and I, and a modest gentlemen that we are, we don't like to ever present ourselves in a prideful or arrogant way. But what we have built, I don't know what the laughing is about.
It's about your face as you said that, the knowing look, the fake hedge.
We have over these years built quite a group of cars that someday. Someday, people in history will talk of the Jerry Sam car collection that we built over these many years, buying and selling, mostly buying, but selling too. And we've built a pyramid. And our philosophy is we occasionally slice off the bottom of the pyramid and build the top.
Ever ascending.
Ever ascending.
The Ponzi Porsche pyramid.
Well, I don't care for that reference. I don't like the connotation.
Maybe the wooden. The what's his name? The who's
wooden,
the coach?
The matchsticks guy?
The UCLA coach.
Oh, Coach Wooden. The
John
pyramid
wooden.
Of success.
The pyramid. The Porsche pyramid of success is what you've built.
I've never heard Wooden talk about a pyramid.
You haven't?
Oh, no.
Everybody knows the Wooden pyramid of success. I am disappointed.
He's the most winningest coach. My kid has a T-shirt of a John Wooden T-shirt.
Anyone
that he wears.
Who encountered Wooden, he was changed. He changed hundreds of lives.
Yes.
Thousands.
Bo Bridges, who played on the UCLA basketball team, was just on talking about how it prepared him not just for basketball, but for life.
Of course. Well, who can't say that they have done that? But anyway, so that, by way of introduction, is Sam Cabilio. That's who he is.
There's the pyramid.
All right. Well, that's not really in the purview of this program.
The pyramid of success.
It's been in it twice now. It actually is.
Forget Wooden. Forget Bridges.
But you guys, look, that was a very long-winded way of saying that you guys have found some of the greatest.
This is my last appearance on this show.
Some of the greatest Porsches
ever
to grace a collection. I mean, you guys find stuff that we lose our minds over. I don't even think the listeners really quite know the depth of rarity and preservation that you find. And Sam, as he was introduced to me in 95 when I was writing for the show, you said, this is the guy that vets these cars and makes sure he inspects welds. He's raced. He's been selling them. He's owned some of the cars you own. He's the guy you go to verify these cars.
Yes.
And that's been true for me. You've found cars for me. For Zuckerman, and, you know, that, I don't know, we should talk about, I think, some of the things you guys have found.
Well, before we get into that, Sam, give us a quick introduction into what got you excited about cars when you were a young boy.
It has to be genetic. It has to be a national thing by virtue of being a little boy in Italy and having little toy cars that I would race around on the floor. And one of my favorite stories, because this only underscores the extent to which this is insanity, is I was maybe 4 years old. We were living at the time in Genova, and my grandmother came up to visit. And so my mother and I go to the market. The market was like a storefront, and when we are going in, I said to my mother, can I stand here by the door because I want to watch the cars going by. And so she said, okay. And, you know, back in those days, they weren't worried about snatching kids and doing that kind of thing. So I'm as happy as could be by the door watching all the cars go by, and I pretty much knew what they all were, and I was four. And it didn't hurt that I had an uncle who had schooled me. So my mother is done with the shopping. She goes home, walks into the house, and my grandmother says to her, dove Sammy? Where's Sam? And my mother goes, ah! She runs all the way back to the store. Well, the reason she was able to walk out and miss me is there were two entrances. She went out a different one than the one from which she came in. When she got back there, I was still there. This is an hour later. I'm still standing there, still looking at the cars, not missing my mother, you know? So that was an early memory of, and then other events of seeing a prototype Alfa Romeo when I was, you know, maybe five or six or something. And then, you know, coming to this country, and back then, American cars were huge and they had the annual model change.
Right.
So I became very interested in seeing how they evolved from year to year. And I had not yet fixated on any particular car. I just liked cars. It didn't matter what they were.
Sam, let me ask you this. You're from Italy. Where's the pivot to the German cars?
Well, I get asked that question all the time. Like, what kind of a traitor are you?
Well, Red Sox and Yankees. Yeah,
exactly. I attribute that to the fact that after my first couple of cars being hot rod Chevys, my first new car was a brand new Beetle. And because of traveling in Germany with my parents when I was little, I kind of knew what Beetles were, and I thought they were cool looking. So I financed a brand new Beetle. My payments were $49 a month.
What year was this, Sam?
64.
How much was the card?
$1,700 and some dollars.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, right around $1,700.
You can get a Gladiator for that right now.
$1,700 a month.
No, $99 a month. They're really cheap.
So
the Beetle.
The Beetle. It was the opportunity to have a brand new car and that I knew would be reliable and fun to drive and all that. So when I took it to the VW dealer for the very first service and the first valve adjustment, I met the mechanic. And this guy was German, spoke with a heavy accent. And we kind of hit it off. And back in those days, there wasn't much speed equipment for VW engines. Today, you can build a VW air-cooled four-cylinder to have five gazillion horsepower, but not then. So one thing led to another, and I found out that it was relatively easy, not super easy, but relatively easy to put a Porsche engine into a Beetle.
Uh-huh.
So with the help of this German mechanic, I found an engine, and he helped me rebuild the engine, and he helped me install it in the Beetle, and that was my first Porsche-powered Beetle, and that was my introduction to Porsche. Prior to then, I didn't... Yeah, I saw them. I knew what they were. They hadn't captivated me the way a Beetle had.
Right. Because the Beetle's more accessible.
And more accessible.
Right.
Yeah, so...
Me too. I knew about Porsches, but I thought, well, you can never have that kind of money. I can never afford that. So I focused on VWs, too, when I was a kid. I liked the front face of the Beetle.
Yeah.
That's what kind of caught my eye. Mm-hmm. It seemed modern, even though the fenders were separate from the body of the car, which was kind of old-fashioned. The no-grill look, to me, just thought, that just seemed cool and modern to me.
Mm-hmm.
And intrigued me.
So that was the introduction to Porsche, which just started growing exponentially from that point. And then
tell the story of the Fiat you built that Hot Rod Magazine wrote about.
That was the result of an evolution of Porsche-powered Beetles. Each one was faster and better than the one that preceded it. But ultimately, it got to the point where there's only so much weight that you can take out of a car.
Right.
And A, still be street legal, and B, drivable. And so one day I was at this independent repair shop in Long Beach, and there was a Fiat 600 there when the engine was out of it. Now, I was familiar with Fiat 600s because people in my family in Italy had them, and I used to ride around in them. I thought they were cool cars. They had no power. And so I'm looking at this Fiat 600 with no engine in it, and I start realizing that dimensionally, it looks like maybe a Porsche could fit in here. And then after a little more measuring and a little more talking, I found one with a blown engine for $75, and I proceeded to remove the engine. And today, this is sheer heresy, put the blown engine into a dumpster.
Oh, wow.
What a mistake that was. But at the time, it wasn't a mistake. So after a little bit of perfecting, got the engine sorted out, resolved some other issues, and then I started street racing with that car. And at the time, the 396 Chevelle was the hot rod car. 1966, 396 Chevelle.
Yeah, SS.
The big rat motor, they called it.
Yeah.
And I started prevailing in late night street racing.
Sidebar. This is a good Zuckerman area. This is 1964. What was the first Chevelle? SS-396, 65, 66, maybe?
At least 65.
Okay,
yeah,
1965.
I think late 65, yeah.
1965. I want you to explain this to me, as only you could. It's 1965. World War II is over for 20 years. Not that long a time.
Right.
In today's terms, we're talking about 2000.
Right.
Okay? The Chevy marketing department is looking for initials to put on their high-performance models, and I'm sure they're sitting around a table with some coffee and donuts and thinking, well, gee, how about how about AA? How about LM? How about TT? How about SS? SS, I kind of like the ring of that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just with no Jews in the room. They didn't think about any Jews in the room.
I'm sure they did. You don't have to be Jewish to have noticed the world was at war in the 1940s and 45.
You know, but why? Okay.
How did that happen? How did that happen? That everybody signed off on that. Yeah, SS. I like SS.
Look, what
I don't
about...
I don't see any negative connotation. Do you, Bill?
Well, if you look at all the RSs out in that moment, the Rensports.
RS is not SS. SS has a very specific connotation.
Right, they called it Super Sport. I have to say, as sensitive as I am, and I'm always looking for these issues, this is one I never saw before, and I'm going to have to now adopt this. I'll credit you two or three times, and then it'll be my observation.
Don't even bother with the two or three. Okay. Just take it and run.
Yeah.
Anyway, that has always mystified me and fascinated me. And when I was a kid, I didn't really know that much about World War II. I was young, and I love those initials, my last name having one of those initials. And when I saw the SSs at Bass Chevrolet on Merrick Road in Amityville, I loved them.
Well, they weren't exactly lightning bolts. I mean, had they been lightning bolt SS, it might have been a little more offensive. But
yeah, it might have cut somebody's eye.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So then, but there was a great story with the Fiat, with the...
Beating the 396s.
Yeah.
All that horsepower, but can't get to the ground in those Chevys.
And one other component, the Fiat weighed 1,340 pounds.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole reason why I searched for another way to go after reaching the end of the envelope with the Beetle, because I couldn't get it much below.
The Fiat is the way forward.
Yeah.
You're the only person who ever found a way forward in a Fiat 600.
Is this now, what were we in last night in your hangar?
We were in a 69 Fiat 850 Coupe, which is way later.
That's
the 600, this is an 850. This was a real motor. Now
right,
you're talking
right.
about real horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
The 600s, that was a two-cylinder or four-cylinder? Four-cylinder.
500 was
But still quite modest. The 500s were twins.
Right.
Wow.
But, okay, so then you start taking this Fiat with the Porsche engine to the drag strip.
Lions Drag Strip in Long Beach. Which, by the way, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in one scene, Brad Pitt is wearing a T-shirt, Lions Drag Strip. When I saw that,
so
that was
cool.
So cool.
Wow.
Well, that was the era, you know.
Yeah,
because they closed Lions down in 1972. But what happened one night at Lions, it was the summer of 66, and they were having a big National Hot Rod Association meet, an annual meet. And on Saturday night, instead of racing cars in their respective classes, they did this thing called ET brackets, where earlier in the afternoon, you would make runs, and they would see what speed, what time you turned, and then they would put you into a bracket that was a half-second bracket, like from 12:50 to 13 seconds, or 13 seconds to 13 and a half seconds, and then you would race later that evening in that bracket, and if you dialed in, that was the terminology, if you dialed in that afternoon at running a 12:80, let's say, in the quarter mile, and the guy next to you was in your same bracket and he ran a 12:60, they would give you a 0.2 second head start on the Christmas tree, you know, the lights coming down.
Really?
Yeah, and that's how they would equalize it, and the whole objective was to equalize based upon the time you turned, to have heads-up competitive racing. So, of all things, when it came my turn to come up to the line, it was just a coincidence. The car that came up next to me was a Dodge Dart from a Dodge dealer called Walker Dodge, and this was a National Hot Rod Association record-holding Dodge. But no big deal, because the times were equalized by virtue of...
But didn't people sandbag to
But then you broke out of your bracket.
See,
if you went faster than your dial-in time, you broke out.
You lost
automatically.
Oh.
So I dialed in, I think, at a 12:83 or something, and this guy was a 12:60. I was spotted those couple of tenths of a second on the Christmas tree. We went for it, and I beat him by maybe the tip of my nose. Well, what happened was there were about 10,000 people there that night. It's July 66. It was a hot day, cool night down by the beach. The editor of Hot Rod magazine happened to be in the stands, and he saw the reaction of 10,000 people to this puny little Fiat beating this record-holding Dodge. The next day, when I was there waiting for my class, during the day it was not ET brackets, it was your regular class. And I was in a class that was below this Dodge. He found me that day and said, hey, I'd like to do an article on your car. Well, what did I know? You know, no one had ever asked me to do an article on anything.
Yeah.
So that ultimately led to the car being in Hot Rod magazine, which, by the way, in that era, Hot Rod magazine disavowed the existence of foreign cars. Hot Rod magazine was only about American cars.
Right.
And so it was a big deal that they did a two-page article on this little Fiat. But the big advantage it had coming off the line from a standing start, it rocketed. And at the other end is when people were catching me, at the other end of the quarter mile.
Because you had the weight over the drive wheels.
Because of that, and because the car was just quick in the lower gears, and I ran out of horsepower on the top end. So,
now, another interesting thing about Sam and I, and this is, you know, I know a lot of car people, as you do, we all do. Sam and I share fascination with Porsches, VW Bugs, and early Fiats.
Now, that is a rather dubious distinction,
right,
which we happen to share.
Strange
trifecta.
We will
be talking about 917s, and then we'll start talking about Fiat 850s.
Yeah, right.
And we're just as excited about both of them.
Just as. Yes.
So that's how we've lasted 25 years.
There's a magic in being able to talk about a 917 Le Mans winner, one of the most spectacular race cars in the history of cars, and then talk about a lowly Fiat 600 or 850.
Yeah.
With the same enthusiasm.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I was driving around in a Fiat with this guy yesterday.
Wasn't that fun? We took the Fiat around the airport last night. And you liked it, didn't you?
It's new. It was just put in the hangar, so it hasn't been sorted yet. But our favorite part is underneath the dash, we pulled a knob with a wire connected to nothing, and it fell on the ground. We couldn't get any of the keys to work, remember?
And I said to Spike, leave that alone. It took me a long time to get it like that.
Yet when
I want the whole wire to come out every time you touch it.
And it wouldn't go over 2,500 RPMs, but we blasted around the airport with no gas in the tank.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was so much fun. And then he pulled it up to the hangar while we smoked cigars, and it's just looking at us with that face.
Yeah.
And the big orange little light.
What a great face.
Oh, it's so friendly. It was like an animated movie.
Did you see it?
There.
Did he post a picture of that?
I didn't see the picture, but I was looking at the face yesterday in the hangar with that very flat sheet metal front, flatness of the sheet metal with just that little line. There's a little bit of a Volkswagen look in the front of that car.
Yes. Again, I was drawn to this no radiator look.
Right.
It just seemed modern to me. When I read in VW Advertising in the 60s, the idea of we're getting rid of that big, heavy drive shaft, and I started to hate the drive shaft. I go, what is that stupid, heavy
that drive shaft.
Metal drive shaft slowing my car down?
Jerry,
you
what's
put
wrong
the engine in the front and the drive wheels at the back, and we got to have this stupid Rube Goldberg contraption to get the... This is moronic.
Why is he pouting around the house? It's a girlfriend?
The drive shaft.
And the drive shaft.
And because the VW Advertising had humor, I was also very drawn to that. And they would talk about, we don't have radiators. We can't boil over. We can't freeze up. I was so drawn to that. I just love modern thinking, new thinking, smart. It just seems smart. VW seems smart to me. And they were self-effacing. I was actually watching a Mad Men scene. Do you remember the scene when they see the VW Lemon ad for the first
yes.
time?
Mm-hmm.
And they have this whole discussion about, this is stupid, making fun of your product, these guys don't know what they're doing. And then John Draper says, yeah, but we've been sitting here talking about it for the past 10 minutes. What does that tell you?
Really?
Right.
What was the name of that ad agency?
Doyle Dane and Birnbach.
Yeah, DDB.
Bill Birnbach, Semitic gentleman from Brooklyn, who convinced VW in the late 50s that they needed humor. Imagine trying to convince Germans in the 50s.
The most humorless people. The most humorless error.
Yes. Yeah. Let's make fun of what you do. And, I mean, that's a sell job right there.
Yeah.
However he pulled that off. And I'm fascinated by that story. And I still think to this day that philosophy and enlightened concept of advertising.
Yeah.
Don't sell the car. Sell your philosophy. Sell your attitude. Sell yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I would see American car ads with all the lease information and all those numbers and, you know,
the phoniness,
just turned me off.
You have some of the original artwork, too.
I do.
It's brilliant.
There was a guy who worked at the agency in the 60s that I bumped into, had a little table at the Lit Show one year. And he had all these drawings, and I bought everything he had. Yeah, always obsessed with that advertising.
Remember the one that said, "How does the snowplow driver get to the snowplow?"
Yeah, sure.
With the yes, that's fantastic.
With what?
With the VW.
With the VW. You never seen that one?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, I've watched every one of those commercials. And you know who picked up on it? Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs saw that, and he picked up on how people are drawn to simple white frames, simple Helvetica font lettering. It draws you in. To this is refined. This is on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
The Apple company has definitely picked up where VW left off in the 60s. By the 70s, they were lost. The end of the Beatle era in the early 70s, they lost their sense of their image, to which they're still searching today.
Right.
Dieselgate, et cetera.
Et cetera. And no more Beetles, no more Golfs, just all SUVs.
Well, they're about to segue into all electric. They're about to find
yes,
it
of
again.
Course. Of
so
course.
They say.
No, they are. I mean,
they have to.
Coming
I don't want to deal with the EPA anymore. Just to get rid of those annoying
bureaucrats who catch us cheating.
Thank you, Paul. I was thinking of a much fouler term. Anyway, so back to the
let's
Sam
talk about
story.
Cars. I mean, we brought up the 917. The three of us were around for the 917.
That story of Sam, Spike, and Jerry and 917-022
on Wilshire Boulevard.
On Wilshire Boulevard in a parking garage.
At Symbolic Motors.
That was symbolic on Wilshire and Las Cienegas.
Yes.
By Nibblers.
Right.
Yes.
It was sitting there in the window.
With a facade, glass showroom.
So peculiar.
But the car was down in the garage.
The car
it wasn't
was
even
down
in the
garage, and we have pictures of it.
Well, they moved it there. I had seen it when I was driving somewhere, I think, to the airport. I was at an intersection, and there it was sitting in a window with some other old cars. And what the
they
hell
had everything
that?
In that store. Everything.
Did you ever go in there?
Yeah, they had a 917, but they had the crappy Dodge Viper. They had they had a little of everything, whatever would sell. Yeah.
But what struck me about it was... John, my business partner, and I were at the height of this Steve McQueen madness, kind of before it was going on. There had been
a decade before.
There was, and we just thought he was the coolest, and that was one of his things. And our mind was kind of blown that this car owned by Steve McQueen.
So John and you got on to McQueen.
Oh, way on. When we first moved to L.A.,
Oh, you knew John from back east?
He and I were interns at Letterman together.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's how we know each other.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool. And now you have your company.
Yeah. It all worked out. But he, you know, he was like, let's drive up to Santa Rosa. I go, why? He goes, you know Steve McQueen? I'm like, yeah, I know Steve McQueen. His house is for sale. I want to go buy it. It's next to a golf course. And I said, let's go. You know, that was just the type of stuff we did.
Wow.
You know, never expecting it to get insane. But then this car.
Let's take this story from square one, the 917. Which any of you Porsche people out there are familiar with. This is the star car from the movie Le Mans.
Yes.
That Steve McQueen bought from Porsche.
Directly from Porsche.
But let's... And the two interesting parts of the story is your awareness of the car and your prescience, if I may.
Excellent word.
And I'll let my favorite part of the story, but I don't want to jump ahead to that part, is your line, which I always quote. But let's go back to where this began. You were aware of the car from the movie coming out in 1970, and then I got into the movie in the mid-90s, and we went on a search to find a 70S like McQueen is driving in the beginning of the movie,
uh-huh.
which led me to buy Henry Meyer's car from Palos Verdes.
Right. That was 3 years before, 4 years before we bought Henry Meyer's car, 97 versus 01.
Right, that's right. So when did you hear that that Bill Noon of Symbolic had gotten a hold of that 917?
Well, I knew it from a year before when the car went to the RM auction in Monterey. And I mentioned it to you at the time.
Right.
And, you know, it was one of numerous cars that we spoke about. And
did it sell?
It did.
It did sell.
Imagine
it
for 1 point, that car going across the block at RM in what year? 99.
No, 2000. I found out about it in 99. The auction was in August of 2000, and Frank Gallagly bought it.
For
1.2.
Frank from New Jersey, the McQueen guy.
Yeah.
Wow. He had that sleek gray.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Right.
So then
he got the hold of that car, too.
Yes.
From Frank, how long did he own the car before
he
it
owned
ends
it
up
about 8 months. And then Bill Noon called me from Symbolic, and because I had talked to Bill Noon when it was going up at, because see, Symbolic was involved with Dick Atwood in bringing the car to this country in the first place.
Tell the fans who Dick Atwood is.
And then it went to Kevin Jeanette in Florida to get brought back to the Gulf livery.
Why didn't he want the car? Why did Frank only keep it for 8 months?
Frank was starting to climb up the ladder age-wise at that point, and I don't think he intended to use it. And, you know, then that was a chunk of money.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a big deal.
I was nervous about buying. I had cold feet about spending that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
And he made some money
would.
On it.
Yeah. Let's not be elitist. By the way,
again, he's smirking.
Just to go back to Dick Atwood, Richard Atwood, Porsche fans, driver of the Salzburg red and white number 23 car.
Race number 23.
That won Le Mans for the Porsche's very first time, 1970, co-driven by
Hans Hermann.
Hans Hermann, right. Right.
Look at and by guys. The way, okay. when Dick
this.
Atwood had that car, the car that is now yours, when he had that car from like 1975 until when he consigned it to RM for the auction.
Right.
That entire time, the car was in the livery of the Salzburg car.
Right. He painted it to look like the car that he won in.
Wow. Okay.
And then it came to the USA.
And at the end of this podcast, I am going to put the car on the market.
Yes. So prepare your $38 million.
Yes.
Anyway, okay. So now we go to Bill Noon. Bill Noon calls you. What does he say?
He had tried to get us to bid on it the year before.
Right.
Okay? So he calls me and says, hey, you know, just in case you want another shot at that car, it's available. And so ultimately that is what, and he said, by the way, because they had a place in La Jolla,
mm-hmm.
and he said, but we've got it in L.A., so it would be very easy for you guys to go see it.
Right.
And that's how we wound up going that night.
Right. So you called me, I called you. And you said, let's just go look at it. It'll be cool to look at it. Because I had no interest in it. I thought, I am not writing that check. That's insane.
I was working you on the side going, you're not going to believe what I just saw on La Cienega. Steve McQueen's 917.
You saw it before I did in the showroom?
Yeah. No, I had seen it driving by. I called you and said, that 917 is there. Yeah.
You saw it driving on the street?
No, I was driving by.
Oh, you drove by. I'm
like
sorry.
I was at La Cienega and Wilshire's,
yes,
where
right.
It was, right?
Yeah.
And I was sitting there, and I looked up, and I went, what the hell is that? When I got home, I looked it up, recalled them, and then it was like, this is Steve McQueen's 917. I immediately called you, and I went, you're not going to believe what's sitting here. I was stunned that this incredible thing, and I think, Sam, correct me if I'm wrong, this is a time still when people didn't care about race cars,
No.
They had started caring about them, and that was the result of vintage racing. Had it not been for vintage racing, there would not have been that interest because you couldn't do anything with them prior to that.
Right.
So vintage racing was already going quite strongly at that point, value-wise, they were nowhere compared to where they are today.
So the three of us end up down there. They moved the car into that little loading dock area. Into the parking garage. I still have pictures of that day.
Yes.
I'll post some when I post this
podcast. That was so cool that you brought that camera.
Yeah, they're little Instamatic 110s.
Yeah.
The throwaway ones?
I don't know what it is.
No.
But they're paper pictures.
Right. Really?
Yeah,
It wasn't one of those box cameras.
I don't know what it was. I don't know what I was shooting. That's I just found these in a suitcase, and I took a little picture with my iPhone so they'd be digital. But it Here's what I remember. Just the three of us staring at this thing for about two straight hours.
Yeah.
And our minds being blown about its rarity, but just the way it looked.
The dimension of a 917. If you've never seen a 917 in person.
We hadn't, right.
The shape and size of it, both how big and how small in various aspects.
Right.
Will really surprise you. You can stare at them. I thought, let's just stop there, and then we'll go do something else. We'll spend 20 minutes looking at it. And we walked around the car for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Couldn't stop observing. Look at it from this angle and this angle.
Yeah, it was sacred.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We were seeing something from the past that had really touched us.
Right.
We had access to that no one else had.
Now, I still wasn't hot to make a move on it.
You were very... You said... I remember you saying to me, why... I'm not worthy of this car. This isn't something I should have. This is something much bigger for someone else.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I said, well, who else should have this? I mean, you were very humble about it, but the rest of us were seeing this developing collection that you had and thought, who better to have it?
Well, Jimmy Spader, the actor and a close Porsche friend of mine, always said to me, you know what's wrong with your collection? And I had maybe 8 cars at that time. He said, you don't have a race car. You got to have one race car just sitting in amongst these regular cars to make this group look cool. So he said that. That got in my head. But you really turned the key with one line, which I will relate. Spike says to me, this is in 2000. He says, you know why I really think you should buy this car? He says, I think, and this is a direct quote, I think Steve McQueen is about to get really hot.
Really?
You don't remember that?
Yeah,
that was your exact words. And I looked at you like you had 6 heads and went, what are you talking about? He's dead. How is he going to get hot? And you said, I just think he is. And that somehow went into my head.
Yeah, the coolness. And that's really John, because he got me crazy about this stuff.
This is the first time learning this, it was John through you to me.
Yeah, that we...
And of course, we didn't realize that the idea of maleness, masculinity, and male virtue was about to become obsolete and bred out of the gene pool. And when people look back and go, hey, what happened to men? Well, let's think back. Who was the last guy that we had that we all thought, hey, there's a real guy. I want to be like that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it landed on McQueen. Well, this is where the facial hair comes from. This is Mario Joyner says, this is the last thing that we have that they can't take. We can grow hair on our faces. Let's see him take that away from us. This is why everyone's so beardy now.
Wow. This is going to be great. Can't wait to hear it on TMZ.
This is the greatest episode of Spike's Car Radio ever.
But
Spike was right. He had no idea, of course. You had no concept of how big McQueen was going to get.
I had an idea of how my enthusiasm with my friends, that's all I was communicating. I wasn't speaking to a larger market, but I was noticing something happening in my little group of guys.
Wow.
That we were nuts about this stuff.
Right.
Anything this guy did, his houses, his places, his sunglasses, we were all looking at it, the watches,
everything he did.
Podcast One has some exciting news. It's official. Our shows are now available on Spotify, and it's free. We want to make it super easy for you and your friends to listen to our podcasts, and joining Spotify allows us to be in even more places for fans to find us. If you're already listening to music on Spotify, you can now listen to our podcasts in the same place. If you're not on Spotify yet, all you have to do is download the free app. That's right, no credit card necessary, and simply search for our shows to start listening.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
Please talk about the motorcycle we bumped into yesterday.
Yeah, that's, you know...
That was unreal.
The genius of Santa Monica Airport is you're walking by hangars, and then there's suddenly these businesses sprout up, and we're walking from Jerry's main hangar to the porn hangar, as we like to call it, with cigars, and there's a guy with about 300 motorcycles in a gigantic airplane hangar that we've never seen before.
You've never seen this?
No.
He doesn't know.
In your row?
Yeah.
This guy just opened up.
Yeah.
He just opened
up. He's got running a business, for some kind of auction business,
one
right?
One guy just cleaning one motorcycle, but 300 of them
packed
jammed in there.
Like handlebar to handlebar. You can't even move.
I don't remember the name of the business. We said, what are you doing? He goes, we're like the Bring It Trailer for motorcycles. We're starting an auction business for motorcycles. And we walk in, and here are all of these beautiful vintage bikes, vintage dirt bikes. Vic Brandstetter is part of this deal. He's been down the airport
Everything,
for a long time.
Exotic Arch. Italian stuff, American stuff.
Right. We saw the Keanu Reeves bike. There was an Arch 1 or
saw
the KRS
a Suzuki 400 dirt bike, the yellow and black tank from the 70s, the Kenny Roberts era. And Spike, jeweler's eye that he has, spots in this row, jammed in with so much stuff.
The Husqvarna. Dirt bikes.
But not just any Husqvarna.
But there were two. And then there's one that has the yellow.
You asked him, I think. Do you had any Huskies? I think you asked the guy.
Yeah. And he said, I do. And it's this bike that if you remember Steve McQueen on the cover of Sports Illustrated doing the jump without his shirt on.
You remember
Chino's.
That picture?
Famous.
Over it's the barbed that wire bike. Fence. It's that exact bike. We got to buy that bike.
It's that. Tear our shirts off.
No, I don't think that. Bike. Same model. But it's the exact model.
I could reenact that photo with my beer gut and my man boobs doing a jump on that bike.
No, we'll get you one of those T-shirts that has abs. You put that on.
Wasn't that movie The Great Escape?
No.
Well, he was doing a jump.
He wasn't in the Husky.
Great Escape. No. He wasn't on a Husky.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, but he was on some World War II German bike or something.
Who was the stuntman? Bud Eakins.
Yeah, yeah.
Whose golf
stuntman.
Racing suit I own.
But we're going to buy that bike, right?
We're going to buy that bike.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You picked one out. I picked. You go nuts. You said it like motorcycles are like guitars or anything. If you start buying them, you're never going to stop.
You can't stop.
No.
Yeah. That's why I don't go near motorcycle magazines or motorcycle stores. To me, it's like strip clubs and like. Why I don't want to look at this stuff. I can't. I don't want to open this door. This door is vault. I'm in a vault now.
Sam, you always know the answers to all questions, right? So here's
that's always, nice
but what he's going to know. You know what I didn't like. My first motorcycle was a Hodaka Combat Wombat, right? And it was a two stroke. And I was 12 years old. And I never liked pouring oil in a gas tank. It never made sense to me.
Oh, I love it.
And if I get this Husky. The Husqvarna, it's a two-stroke, right? And I'm going to have to do that.
It might have an automatic oiling system. Some of those, they started to get those in the 70s. It's got to be 60s.
Yeah, no, it's
I think that
70s.
Didn't start till the 70s, automatic oiling.
But what do I, but do I mix the oil and the gas?
Yeah, it's like a man it does it. Like a
no,
man.
The easiest way to do it is pre-mix it in a can.
Uh-huh,
you have different gradients, levels on the can.
Yes.
So you put the gasoline up to one level. And then add the oil to the next level that's indicated, and then shake it up and pour
like
it in
a
the
protein
bike.
Protein shake, and that's it.
Yeah, that's the way to do
like
it.
A protein shake.
Are we buying that bike?
You want it? You want in?
Let's get it.
I
you
think
want to
plan
to
have it? I mean, when you and he pulls up the McQueen shot from Sports Illustrated,
you're done.
And we're looking at the forks. It's the same exact bike.
And you lose it, right?
Yeah.
You want that?
You want me on that wall?
It has a nice dent in the gas tank.
Oh, it does?
It's good. Yeah, it's going to be good.
Question. Now, at some point, though, now I'm confused.
It's a dirt bike, though.
I thought the 917 Chad McQueen drove that for you. Why is Chad
McQueen? Well, that's another chapter in the story.
Okay. Let's go back. You're right, though. We should get back on track here with the 917. Where did we leave off?
Because we still haven't bought it yet.
No.
And it hasn't gone to Willow.
Correct. The next step was when we rendezvoused at Willow.
Symbolic said, come out to the track. We're going to have a 512 Ferrari out there. We'll bring the 917 out.
Exactly.
Right.
You and Jerry, and you were kind enough to bring me along.
And we drove up with the Gunas, right?
I think so. That was that was a crazy drive. I don't think he was there. But here's what I remember. You were in... I was in the 73 RS that all four of us have owned.
Oh, isn't this crazy?
Yeah, right? That's another great story.
You were in some sort of turbo or something.
You were in the blue Turbo S.
The blue Turbo
S. The 97
S.
Turbo S.
And a grimace because he sold the car. But here, do you remember the moment that I remember? We were coming down a hill.
Yes.
At a high rate of speed.
Yes, very high rate
There's
of speed.
There's no one on the highway, so we goosed it a little over.
No, I was in Zuckerman's GT2.
I think so.
Oh,
I was in the Adriatic blue 914 1970 color GT 996 GT2, the first GT2 that they made.
Oh, you know.
That's what I drove up
What
there.
Year would that be?
And you were in the orange.
No, Jerry, that's not possible because the GT2 was an 02 model. It came out at the end of 01. We did this in April of 01.
But it was a blue car.
I'm positive
car.
You had your turquoise blue 97
okay, right.
We
were getting on
another
it.
Another trip, another venture.
And at the height of getting on it,
yes,
we went right through a radar trap,
yep.
A laser, and but the police officer was looking down. And when we got to the track, we were like, what do we have to do to get a speeding ticket?
Yeah.
Because we just went, boom, just right by. Boy, that was really fun.
It was so fun. And the cop just looked up and said, nah, there's no way somebody would do that right in my face.
Bright
so
orange.
I must not be seeing it.
Bright blue, over 100.
The Adriatic Blue GT2. The reason you're thinking of that is because we did have that at Willow later on.
Okay. All and, right. So back, let's cut back to
the car.
Willow Springs. Chad McQueen kindly shows up, son of Steve McQueen, because he hasn't seen the car in some years,
I
imagine.
And he had ridden in it on his dad's lap when he was a little kid.
Right.
And Cibalik knows we want to put on a show for these guys.
Right.
A little mini Le Mans.
Trying to close me.
That's what it was. Right.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. And I remember we, at first.
Which is nothing I love better, by the way.
Yes, than
being
close.
Is when a salesman puts his eyes on me and says, I'm going to close you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, do it, baby.
Right.
I love getting sold. It's another reason I love Sam. He's a fantastic salesman,
yes.
And he takes his time.
Mm-hmm.
When he's selling you a car, he tells you a story like Mr. Rogers.
Yes, it's great.
And he's
always
a great talker.
How it reminds him of some evening in 1973 on the Italian Riviera.
Yes, I was driving from Valencia
right.
with a glass of sangria in my hand, and I shifted from third to fourth.
Yes.
I've got a lot of those stories. Lots of them.
Nothing also, will sell me on a car as when Sam also, says, I drove one of those from Dusseldorf to Calabrese on a midnight bonsai run.
Yeah. How about when you look at the carbon on the exhaust in this spot right here, Spike? That came right from the factory. It has not been touched.
Those are the details I Sam, like. Sam, 10 million. That's 10 more podcasts with the same stories.
All right, but back to the 917, because the first thing we saw was the Ferrari 512 coming around that last turn on Willow.
Right, yeah.
An image that, again, the internet's not really there doing this
that's
stuff.
That's right.
So we hadn't heard these cars or really seen them do that.
Right,
at least Jerry and I, right?
Yeah.
And we went, oh, my God.
The sound of a Ferrari 512.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
who was driving the cars?
Chad drove the 917. I'm not sure who drove the Ferrari.
Right.
The Ferrari.
Ferrari.
We were waiting for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
Como comes out.
So they pull out the 917.
Yeah.
Some pleasantries with Chad. He gets into the 917 and goes out for his first lap.
So we're standing there. Me, Spike, Sam, watching the 917. Turn one. Wow, that sounds cool. Turn two. That sounds cool. Turn three. Hey, I think I just saw the front wheel pass on Chad's right. That's odd. Don't you need four wheels? And we see this tire bouncing through the infield, and Chad somehow still driving. I'm going, wow, that's a neat trick. What a car this must be.
Yeah.
It uses wheels occasionally.
Do you remember what you said to me?
No.
Well, that's the end of that.
My God.
Car. Yeah, I'm
and
sure.
Then and then the masking tape came out. Remember that?
Well, we drove out to the corner. We drove out to the turn.
Oh, we did.
And while you were listening to everybody talk about what had happened, they hadn't put the big nut tightened, I was quietly collecting pieces of Steve McQueen's 917, the Gulf Blue Flex and Orange Flex, which were on the ground, and putting them in my pocket. I have those somewhere. I have
really?
Those pieces. Yeah, it was Steve McQueen's 917
Do you know
pieces.
What those are worth?
What are they worth?
Something. Are you
Something,
kidding?
Right?
Seriously.
Little trinkets, little...
Many thousands, wouldn't you say, Paul?
Absolutely.
Many thousands.
I'll broker the deal right now.
I put them in a little baggie and show
like
them my
relics.
Friends. Do you know what you're looking at right here? Chiclets? Nope.
Oh, boy.
What happens after that? They did put the wheel back on. They did drive the car.
We did not make a deal that day.
No, we didn't, but we did soon after.
Yeah, soon after.
Well, we did some negotiating.
Yeah.
Because they wanted X amount, and we offered X amount, and we did our usual little tap dance.
So how long after that, then, did you guys buy the car?
Less than a week.
Right. I had gone back to New York, and I was shooting a pilot with Barry Martyr in New Jersey, Cranford, New Jersey. When he told me about that town, I said, we got to shoot it there. That's a funny name for a town.
Yeah. But where you don't want the car, you say that's the end of that. At what moment did you change your mind and say, I want to buy this car, and it's time?
I don't know. I told you, it was... Sam's the greatest car salesman in the world, but it was really your line.
Right.
Steve McQueen's about to get hot. I believed you. I thought, I don't know why. I think he's right. And I think this car has value. And Jimmy Spader's line is, you need a race car. And I remember dragging Jimmy to the hangar and saying, and pulling the cover off of the car and showing him, look, I got a race car. That's all it was to me. It's a race car. You know, it looks cool. And never thinking for a second that I had made the greatest move of my life. Car collecting move of my life.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
The little seat, the little back area where you put the suitcases. There were so many
camera
mounts were on it, right?
Camera mounts are still on it.
So, Sam, here's a question for you now. How do you, now that it's smashed a little bit, how do you go about vetting that car for authenticity? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
how
totally.
Do you look it over? What are you looking for?
Well, as far as...
Well, I think the listeners really want to know. I mean, there aren't many of these cars out there, right?
Exactly. It's that car.
No, I know. But when he inspects the car, what does he look at? And the 917 is the question.
All right.
Okay, in the case of the 917, had it not been for how much I'd hung around racetracks all my life and had seen these kinds of cars, even though I had not seen any 917s, well... I had seen 917s, but not able to stick my head inside and all that. But I was quite familiar with other Porsche race cars of the era, and I knew how the frames looked, and I knew how the VIN tags looked, how they were attached, many other things about the frame. So, and then the beauty of this particular car is that it was unrestored.
Yeah.
So it's not like it was a car that was taken down to as many pieces as it could break down into and refinished to be perfect. It was still, it had original dirt on it, I like to call it.
The original dirt.
Yeah.
I love original dirt.
So,
original dirt.
It also had the camera mount in the front.
They're in the front.
Yeah, in the front.
Aside from paperwork all over the place from Solar Racing.
Well, that was critical. All the documentation, the provenance, having known where it was every step of the way.
Right.
And ironically, when Steve McQueen sold the car, he sold it to two gentlemen who had a small race team in Germany called Auto Usdau, USDAU. Well, none other than Reinhold Jost and Willy Kaussen. And so this is a little aside, but in my office in Signal Hill, I have various old Porsche racing posters, and one of them is of the Nürburgring 1971, and the face of the poster is a certain 90803 in Martini and Rossi livery, and I happen to know a lot about that car for other reasons I'm looking, okay, it won the race, and then there was another 90803 that finished second, and then an Alfa Romeo 33-3 that finished third, and to make a long story short, there was a 917 that finished fifth or sixth overall, but it won its class. It's your car.
Right.
Your 917 in the hands of Reinhold Jost was defeated by the 90803 that won the race, which ultimately became the property of Reinhold Jost.
Right.
So, anyway, I was the provenance of this car, having known every single owner. McQueen bought it himself from Porsche Solar Productions. By the way, Solar Productions, the word solar was from the name of some street he used to live on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never knew that.
Mount Olympus?
I was reading something recently.
In the valley.
In the valley, yeah. I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, when he first met Neely, his that wife,
yeah,
the mother of Chad.
Adam, I think. Here's a Steve McQueen item I came across the other day. Solar Productions was based, guess where? Same studio where I did my show. 4024 Radford.
Oh.
In
Studio City.
Studio City.
Yeah.
I mean,
how about that?
It was in the scriptures that you were going to buy this car.
Yeah.
You know who else was there? Gilligan's Island.
That's right. Oh, Gilligan.
The lagoon was there when you were still doing your show. Did you know that?
Yes. I know you guys used to go down there.
Well, when you hired me, on my first day, I went down there. I went down to see this sacred place.
The lagoon.
Yeah. Not the Seinfeld bungalow.
Yeah.
Gilligan's Island's lagoon that Larry Sanders was then using as their... Remember in one of the episodes, he escaped to Montana to live in a house in the middle of nowhere?
No.
That's what it turned into after that. And then they paved it, and we shot down
Well,
there.
I have to admit, I never visited it.
Yeah.
I never saw it. And I love Gilligan's Island. But back to the 917.
That's what the listeners are saying in the car. Enough about Gilligan. Talk about that 917.
When was your first drive?
That's a good question.
Probably at Willow, the time that you had the Adriatic Blue GT2 there.
Right.
That could be another.
And I got in that car, and to this day, you get in that car. There are two cars in my life that I have been in. One is that car, and the other is Ralph Lauren's... GTO. Those are the only two cars I have. Those are the two cars I have been in, both 12s, that you get in them and you do feel that you are a Greek god streaking across the sky on the wings of Apollo. You feel that you have lassoed the sun and you are being swept through the universe by some extraterrestrial force. By the way, did you see the video last night of the UFO, the Southern California, was a great video. It was in the LA Times.
I didn't.
Oh, fantastic video. Really looks cool. Big, long stick of light, just something. That's not a plane. And, like, everybody calling the police and
Bill
everybody.
Bill was just telling me SpaceX has been launching satellites, and there are more launching tonight.
Well, maybe that's who it was. Anyway.
I hate people to think you believe in aliens.
When I was explaining to somebody the other day what it's like to get in a 917 and to drive it. Of course, the most amazing thing about it, being a Porsche, you can drive it. You know, I'm just a regular guy. I'm not a race car driver. I'm just a guy who likes to drive cars. I got in it, turned the key, it starts, you put it in first, you let up the clutch, and off you go. And next thing you know, you're flying around a racetrack. The view out the windshield, the sound behind your head, the colors, those two cars are the greatest automotive experiences I've ever had. Honorable mention, the 908-3 Targa Florio winner, which I think is the greatest handling car I've ever driven, if you're into your Porsche prototype race cars.
Sam, the little seat next to it that doesn't have the seatbelt in it, right? The passenger seat. That was just there to qualify for racing?
The FIA regulations and mandated the seat. They mandated so many. Basically, these were ostensibly road cars. They had to meet certain criteria.
Headlights, turn signals.
Right.
Trunk.
And trunk. The 917
and this
trunk.
Car has spare. A title right now, right? You could...
The 917?
Yeah, you could make it street
doesn't,
legal.
It doesn't. We could probably get one legally.
Because it has directionals and headlights.
Oh, yeah. Well, it does have those kinds. You know, I'm not sure if it has directionals, but it wouldn't be difficult to add them. But but it does have road equipment. It does have normal road equipment. And from the standpoint of the motor vehicle code, it would take very little for the car to comply.
Can you put into our show today the sound of a 917 starting up and revving?
Yeah, we can do it right now at this moment.
Let's do it. So
you
this is what it sounds like, kids, when you start up a 917.
That. Now let's hear one at speed, because that's really where you hear it.
Yeah. So try and imagine you're in this vehicle. It's 1970. You've got a 5.4-liter. What's the horsepower?
550?
580.
Well, the 5.4 was 580.
Okay, 580 horsepower. It's night. You're on a public road in France, which is part of the Le Mans course, as they lay it out. You're on a public road at night in the rain.
5 miles long. The Mulsanne is
right.
5 miles
long. 5 miles long. You're doing 240 miles an hour with your feet in front of the axle of the car. In front.
In the rain sometimes.
In the rain at night.
At night.
Yeah.
Talk
and
about
you,
manliness.
You,
yeah.
You noticed it right away. I remember you getting in the car when you took it out the first time. When that door closes.
Yeah.
You know, the open cockpit versus the closed cockpit.
Yes.
There is a moment of seriousness.
Yeah, there's a what we call a sack moment.
A squinchy.
Yeah, it's a sack squinch. Where you feel like your tailor has just made an error on your suit.
Because somebody
you
said...
You got to let that out a little, Sal.
You know, somebody said somewhere during that day or one of the days it's been at the track, you know, they had a reputation for just exploding for no reason. Yeah. Like, what? They just explode for no reason? Yeah, you know, they just might. Or if you downshift the wrong way, it explodes.
So
that's just
and
one
we
of
own the
cars.
Car to this day, no. And we're going to display it at Pebble Beach this August.
I was going to bring that
There's
up.
It's going to be a 917 celebration at Monterey, the famous Pebble Beach Concours, and they're bringing eight significant 917s.
It looks like it's going to be eight. Miles Collier's car is going to be one of them.
Wow,
the
I love
winner.
That car.
And two from the Porsche factory.
Wow. I'm sure 01 will be there.
Oh, yeah. One of them is 01.
Yeah.
And
may I suggest in real time that we do a 917 panel this year at Pebble?
Sure.
Isn't that the idea?
Well, there sure.
You go. So why don't we Brilliant. Have a panel on the 917? We'll have Jerry. We'll have Sam. We'll have Miles. Well, the guys who know these cars, because look, we just took up 45 minutes talking about one car.
I wonder if they're going to
Hurley drive
Atwood
one of those,
there.
Huh? Hurley Haywood drove a 917.
Highly likely, I would think.
Yeah, get Dick Atwood.
Yeah. All right, we're
and
doing.
Watch him and cry course, when course. We tell him what the car's worth now and what he sold it.
Tell
for.
Him right on the panel and hand him a gun. Here, it's worth X amount. Here's the gun. Blow your brains okay. out.
Now here's a good Bam. Reason.
Splat.
Everyone clapped. Laughter and applause. Okay. A standing ovation.
Do it again.
They would pass the gun around because as car guys, we've all made this mistake.
Yeah.
We've all let a
have
great
Bill
car
Noon
pass.
Up there. Everybody that owned this car, pass the gun around. Clam, clam.
Now, cheering, clapping. I need another cup of coffee. This is great.
Now, this could have been...
917 death panel.
This could have been a good reason to have a divorce. When Brian Redman bought the car from the company that put a lien on the car after Auto Ustau, Yost, and Willy Kausen had it, it went somewhere and they... wound up putting a lien on the car, and that's how Yost lost the car.
Uh-huh.
Brian Redman bought it, and Brian Redman's wife got totally upset with Brian because he paid like $15,000 for the car.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, this was in 1975. And then she was sort of okay with it when he flipped it to Dick Atwood and made a couple grand on it.
He told me he sold it to buy a bigger house.
Right, exactly.
They had saw a house that they wanted to buy. They needed some cash, and they flipped it.
Imagine the house.
Laughter from
buy.
Jerry. I win.
King Tut
bonbons. Bonbons and cigars for everyone.
Wow.
Wow. Well, this is a great show.
Are you ending it?
You should end it now. Don't get
we
this.
Went,
is a
we went
beautiful,
long.
We can
great.
Do it. We can do it again. Anytime. Because there's so many cars that you guys have bought together. We didn't even touch on the Tangerine
and
911
we have
RS
to do
that we've all owned
guys,
together.
The Tangerine RS that we all
But
own.
Sam, while you're here, just indulge me for 5 minutes. Because there are a lot of listeners out there that really don't know how to buy a 911 or a 356. Stop making fun of me. And I just want to give them just one, because I know that's one of the reasons they're listening to this episode. Just can you just give them some basic tips if they're not around a person like you on how to vet an early 911, a 356? What do you look for? What do you not look for?
Before you even look at the car, I would ask to see as much documentation that they have relative to the car, whether it's work orders, invoices, or chain of ownership, past owners. Because if you approach the car already with that background, you can already start understanding and seeing things instead of going cold turkey up to the car. And
you've said that to me on the phone before. I've sent you a car and you go, let me see if I can eliminate it.
That's what I always
try
to do.
By looking at the ad and looking at the paperwork.
I like to eliminate it without going to look at it.
Right. Great tip.
And then
if
I can't, then I'm forced to go look at it.
Right.
And then, I mean, you have to have some knowledge about cars in general in order to be able to draw any conclusions. If you don't know anything about cars, you can be seduced by any car. And if you don't know a lot mechanically, then you pretty much have to hire somebody who does. But that's not easy to do either.
You look for matching numbers.
Yes, but when you're looking at the car like that, you're not going to have that documentation in front of you necessarily.
Right.
But the main thing is use common sense. Open up everything that'll open. Lift up floor mats. You'd be amazed what you find under floor mats at times.
Mice feces.
Yeah, and if we're talking about a Porsche 911, lift up all the carpeting in the front trunk, and if it's a 911 up to and including 1989, open the smuggler's box, which I'm sure that when U.S. Customs, a few years before that, discovered that door opened inside the trunk, and there was this huge cavity, they probably thought, I wonder how much stuff got by us prior to this.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, just use common sense. Look everywhere you can. Look for, if you see an area that's got a patina, like a layer of dirt that looks normal for usage, and now you've got an area that looks brand new, something's not right. Same thing in the engine compartment. If the engine is perfectly clean and the rest of the car looks like it's got miles on it, then somebody cleaned it to hide things. Common sense is just a great starting point.
There it is.
But at the end of that point, you've got to get someone who's mark specific, who then can see things that are another layer or two down.
Right. Are you still buying cars for people? If someone wants to vet a serious race car or some big money car?
Yeah, a little bit.
You get in touch with Sam Caviglio.
You know, I've got a good thing going with one particular guy, and he keeps me pretty busy. I no sooner finish one deal than I'm off on another one. And, I mean, like the Fiat 850. You'd be surprised. You know what?
Well, we saw four new cars in the hangar when we were down there the other day.
Some of these little cars, believe it or not, are more work than the big ones.
They're harder to find.
Yeah. And then sometimes, you know, you've got to use a howitzer to pry them loose from the people who own them.
We're specializing in what we call releasing the grip.
Yeah.
Hammering. What do you hammer with? Bags of money.
Cash howitzer. Right.
There are many articles of persuasion.
That's funny.
That's just one more weapon in our arsenal.
Yeah.
But so many cars come to you guys. I mean, I remember on the show, that's what was... I was looking at crumbs that dripped off your plate, you two. You'd be like, oh, there's this 73 911T from Tennessee with 12,000 original miles. It's white and black. I don't like white. You should buy this.
Oh, yes.
Sam found it. You know, what? That incredible car.
Right.
Scraps.
Yes.
That was a scrap.
Yeah, well, car. When you cut a piece of cake, there's always crumbs.
thinner. Just a little bit.
Anyway, Sam, long overdue. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Of course, you're the most requested guest to return host, really, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
You. Yep.
We have
Wind, and Fire.
We have Earth, Wind, and Farah, but it really all begins with you here in Zuckerman and here at the Malibu Kitchen. That's it. And you know what? We'll all be up in Monterey, and we're going to do a 917 panel. So you can catch up with us there and hear some more about these cars, because these guys, you know, have a unique experience with them. And as you've just heard, it's fascinating. Fascinating stuff.
It's a big, big part of this game or this hobby is the stories, the people, and the journey of finding and acquiring these things. We love the cars, but we also love everything around the pursuits, the analysis, the conversation. It's, as I said in the beginning about the barbell, it's a world of madness, and I think we'd all be a little lost without it.
All right, let's have some breakfast.
All right.
All right, see you next week, guys.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.